This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Hey, how's it going? Well, this week, ever heard of closed-loop manufacturing? We'll take a look at industrial design students have been looking at using scrap to make stuff and then make sure it's all easily recyclable. And humans versus wildlife in the suburbs. And finding music in the junkyard.
They're called Junkyard Symphony. Two guys dressed in khaki green jumpsuits playing on instruments they made themselves.
But first, here are some of the stories we're following this week. Officials from local governments at the city and county level are lobbying Congress to put more money into wastewater treatment projects this year. President Bush's proposed budget would cut money for keeping up maintenance and building new sewage treatment plants. The White House wants to reduce the money available for a loan program. It makes federal loans to local governments so they can make sure sewage and stormwater systems don't pollute rivers and lakes. Gary Becker is the chair of the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, a group made up of local officials. He says there's a huge need for full funding of the program.
As population expands, as cities grow, as municipalities grow, you have a constant need to expand the plants. In addition to being able to upgrade the ones that were put in 30 years ago when the Clean Water Act was put together.
Becker says he hopes Congress will reverse the president's cuts to the loan fund. The Bush administration has generally said it's trying to shrink spending on everything, except for the military, as a way to reduce the federal budget deficit. It's a loan program. Doesn't that mean you eventually get the money back? And while we're on the subject of the federal government, two government agencies are agreeing to work together to test chemicals in products we use. There are still lots of hurdles and years of delays before products already on the shelves can be tested for safety. 3 years ago, a government report showed the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency could not assess the health risks of 85% of the chemicals in the products you probably have in your bathroom or out in the garage. The Government Accountability Office found part of the reason then and now was because laws protect corporations' secrets over public knowledge about health risks. On top of that, other reports found the EPA was years behind in testing chemicals. Now the EPA and the National Institutes of Health are going to be working together to test chemicals faster and without using test animals. The agencies will be testing the safety of chemicals ranging from pesticides to household cleaners to see if they harm human health. The one problem? It will take, quote, many years to validate the new testing methods before the testing program can be fully implemented. A new online encyclopedia wants to give all living things on Earth their own websites, even the mosquitoes and leeches. Rebecca Williams has more on that.
The Encyclopedia of Life is like MySpace for bugs, birds, and bottom feeders. There are bios, photos, and videos of 30,000 species on the site. But the scientists who run the site are planning pages for every species on Earth, all 1.8 million of them. Jesse Ossabell helps manage the encyclopedia. He wants you to be able to pull up the site on your phone or BlackBerry while you're on a hike, like a field guide to find out what that funny-looking bug is.
But it's also for scientists looking for large patterns in nature. If you want to study all plants that have purple coloring or all animals that live at least 60 years.
Ossabell says in a few months, they'll launch the interactive version of the encyclopedia. Experts will make sure the science is accurate. But if you want to blog about your favorite spider, there's room for that too. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
People who go fishing might be attracted to a new environmentally friendly lure. Chuck Kornbach has that story.
Soft plastic lures such as wiggly worms are often made more flexible by adding chemical compounds called phthalates. These chemicals have been linked to adverse health effects, and when the lures are torn off a hook, the compounds pollute waters. Tim Oswald is a mechanical engineering professor at the University of Wisconsin. He's helped a manufacturer come up with a process that uses tiny plastic fibers inside the lures. Oswald says the microfibers make the lures stronger.
Using this technology, they no longer would end up in the bottom of the lake, or at least at a much, much smaller rate.
Oswald says the lures no longer stretch like a piece of rubber, but still turn and wiggle and have that worm-like feel. He says the reinforced lure might cost a little more in the stores, but he says they're likely to last longer. For the Environment Report, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
We'll be right back. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. In a bit, a look at the big fight, the new human neighbors moving into the country and finding there's someone already there.
I mean, at a certain point, it starts to feel like...
In this corner, with acres of ravaged lawns and gardens to their credit, we have the wildlife.
But first, people who make everyday items from cars to chairs to cell phones attractive and functional are called industrial designers. Now, a new generation of industrial designers is learning how to create products that are environmentally friendly as well. That makes their jobs a little bit more challenging. Anne Dornfeld has that story.
A lot of the things you buy have a pretty limited life cycle. Think about it. Before you buy a product, it uses up raw materials. Then you use it for a while. Then it ends up in a garbage dump. But that doesn't have to be its fate. A group of industrial design students at Western Washington University was given this challenge: create attractive, useful products that are also completely recyclable, reusable, or biodegradable. On top of that, they had to use waste that would have ended up in the dump. Rachel Bjarnason explains what's known as closed-loop design.
Instead of a product life cycle and a designer's job ending with that product when the product is at the end of its useful life, that is just a new material that can be reused and turned into a new product.
This sustainable design principle has caught on in Europe. There, household appliance manufacturers are required to take back old dishwashers and clothes dryers to reuse their components. U.S. factories are adopting closed-loop systems, too, as a way to save money on raw materials and benefit the environment. One of the first lessons the students learned was that in closed-loop design, it's not enough to use recyclable materials. You have to think about how you attach one material to another.
If you have a recyclable material, like an aluminum bonded to a plastic that's non-recyclable, suddenly the recyclable component is no longer recyclable.
Bjarnason says they had to avoid using strong glues for that reason, and also because the adhesives can release toxic fumes. The students also had to figure out where to get their raw materials. Seth Tucker wanted to make bracelets out of disposable chopsticks.
I found that between Japan and China, 1 billion pairs of chopsticks are thrown away every year. They're taking down whole forests just for chopsticks.
He asked local Asian restaurants whether he could install chopsticks recycling bins to collect enough for his project.
Some restaurants, it was kind of funny, they gave me this kind of look like, you're crazy, I would never, you know, give you used chopsticks. But it was really cool because other places were like, oh yeah, totally, we're definitely cool with the idea.
Tucker sanitized the chopsticks he'd collected, cut them into pieces, and sandblasted them into what looked like little driftwood beads. He strung them into bracelets, along with natural turquoise and antique African trade beads. One student turned newsprint into biodegradable flower pots. Another made used-up retail gift cards into colorful luggage tags. Rachel Bjarnason challenged herself to use fabric scraps that she usually throws away in her job as a seamstress. She stitched strips of silk into baby booties and lined them with scraps of fleece she got from a local glove manufacturer. Then she cushioned the soles with leftover carpet padding from a flooring company.
So all of this was materials that would have been thrown out, and I turned them into little striped baby booties.
Several stores agreed to carry the products. One of them was Goods for the Planet in Seattle. Suzanne O'Shea is the co-owner.
We were thrilled to do it because one of our goals is to find products as close to home as possible and support the local economy.
The students' products were a hit with their customers. O'Shea says some even sold out right away, like the chopsticks bracelets. And sushi rollers made from stainless steel bicycle spokes flew off the shelves.
A lot of chefs that have come in and people that make sushi at home have really been impressed with this design because it has more weight than the standard bamboo sushi rollers.
And that's the idea. Student Rachel Bjarnason says they learned the ideal sustainable product is at least as attractive and useful as the competition.
You still need to make a product that looks beautiful and has good tactile sensation and is something that people ultimately want to buy. Even if it has the best of intentions in saving the environment, it won't do its job if it's not something that people want or need.
The students say they'll try to integrate the closed-loop design principles they've learned into all of their future products. They don't want anything they design to ever end up in the trash. For the Environment Report, I'm Ann Dornfeld.
This is the Environment Report. A little later, a look at a band whose musical instruments came from the junkyard. But first, wildlife and their new human neighbors. More and more people are moving into areas that are natural habitats for animals, and a lot of people are finding that the animals don't want to move out of the neighborhood. Kyle Norris reports this can make for some interesting interactions.
Get this. Woodpeckers want to live inside Tom Winowski's house.
There's a hole, and when you're in the house, here's what you hear. You're in the house, and you hear this. And you know you're being attacked.
Winowski's not so keen on sharing his house with the woodpeckers. He managed to scare that one away. But then another woodpecker made a pretty good-sized hole on the other side of the house. Winowski put up one of those menacing plastic owls, you know, to scare the woodpecker away. And he thinks it's working. He'll probably even buy another plastic owl. You know, with those cute eyes all wide. Winowski lives in a suburb, but it's sort of out in the country. It's got dirt roads and, you know, lots of trees and lots of wildlife in the area. Winowski started having problems with animals pretty much the day they moved into the house. Actually, he can list off his problems to the ABCs.
Well, let's start with A. Ants haven't been a big problem. There's been a few, but none in the house, and they're out there, so leave them alone. B. You have bees and bats.
Okay, so this could go on for a while, so I'm going to jump in here. Bats were living in the attic. Carpenter bees chewed holes in the siding. So for D, you've got deer. The deer ate pretty much all the landscape plants. Okay, so now let's jump to F. There was this fox. It had been living in Winowski's drainage ditch, and it would bury its kill in the lawn. You know, things like dead smelly skunks. Yeah. So one day, Winowski was getting his mail, and the fox came strolling out of the woods, and they locked eyes. Winowski noticed that the fox was small and red and beautiful, but he was tired of dealing with it.
So I took this rock and I put it in front of the drainage ditch hole, and he watched me do that like it was almost like, what are you doing to me here? So then he went next door and went in their drainage ditch.
Winowski's not the only guy who's battling it out with the wildlife. As people keep moving into areas near wildlife, there are problems. I mean, at a certain point, it starts to feel like...
In this corner, with acres of ravaged lawns and gardens to their credit, we have the wildlife. And in this corner... With a hoe, live traps, and a BB gun, we have the human homeowners.
But experts say it does not actually have to be us versus them. Jennifer Kleitch is a wildlife technician with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. She says people need to realize they're part of the problem. You know, dog food outside is a free meal for coyotes. And people who mow their lawns all the way to the edge of a pond create paradise for geese, short grass near water. And then there's this kind of thing, which can happen with raccoons.
If we leave all our garbage and they get into it, we get mad and they're being a nuisance, but we are, in essence, responsible for them being there and being drawn to it.
She says people tend to look at it as if animals are the problem, but the people moved into the animals' neighborhood. Stephen Van Tassel says we're conflicted about wildlife. He's a wildlife damage educator with the University of Nebraska Lincoln Extension Office.
We tend to have the Disney effect with wildlife, and that is wildlife are wonderful and they're beautiful, and we have these sort of rather pastoral images of a person walking through a deep forest and seeing the deer in the distance. And then that attitude can change dramatically when they see that same deer ravaging a plant they paid $500 for to have put in their backyard.
He says when people start thinking of wildlife as evil, as in, that thing that tore up my flower bed is evil. Well, that can be bad. The animals are not the enemy. They're part of the environment, the same environment that people want to live in. So Tom Winowski, you know, the ABC guy? Yeah, well, he says his perspective has changed a little over time. He still thinks that if animals are destroying his property, yeah, well, then they've got to go. But he's starting to realize that there are things he can do to discourage the wildlife from damaging his property without waging war. He's kind of getting into it, actually. He started reading up on different animals, and he says he likes and respects animals, even the mole tearing up his lawn. He thought it was a whole colony. Turned out it was just one mole, but one heck of a hard-working mole. Experts say there are a lot of things you can do that are simple and easy to prevent problems, like modify bird feeders to guard against squirrels. Chimney caps discourage uninvited guests from dropping in. And people can fill in cracks and crevices around their home to stop things like bees and mice from sneaking in. But the experts say that the best thing is to cool your jets. Stop viewing the animal as the problem and realize that the animal is just trying to do its thing. As for the wildlife around Tom Winowski's place, yeah, well, they're stalled at the letter W, which is the first letter in his last name. The animals are still trying to learn how to live with him. For the Environment Report, I'm Kyle Norris.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. It takes a keen eye to see the value in an old hubcap, a dented bucket, or a broken bicycle horn. But when you're searching for musical instruments, the junkyard can be an inspiration. Karen Kelly has that story.
It's a winter weekend festival in Ottawa, Canada, and it's freezing. But there are a few things you can count on. Ice skating, ice sculptures, maple taffy, but bongo drums? As you make your way along the crowded path, you catch sight of the band, and you realize these guys aren't playing bongos. They're playing on recycling bins. And they've got paint buckets hanging on either side of them. Those bottle caps that are taped to the top turn them into snare drums. And there are PVC pipes sticking out of the bin with metal bowls on top. Those would be the cymbals. And believe it or not, they sound really good. They're called Junkyard Symphony. Two guys dressed in khaki green jumpsuits playing on instruments they made themselves. Johnny Olson is the founder of Junkyard Symphony.
Usually what I do is I go to the junkyard and I just look through stuff and take my stick and bang on stuff and pretty much experiment with different sounds, and I get a lot of ideas for bits in the show just from the props that we find. Just use your imagination, basically.
Like a beat-up cheer detergent box. During the show, Olson picks a little kid out of the audience to hold that box up in the air. And the audience does what it's told.
Thumbs up is a cue for a cheer. We don't say woo, we say yay, it's a little bit more effective.
Yay!
Well, usually is. Try it again.
Yay!
You don't have to mean it, just make it loud.
Yay!
Much better.
Olson started Junkyard Symphony about 20 years ago when he was in high school. But what started as an Earth Day project became a summer job that put him through college. After graduation, he tried to stop, but couldn't.
And then once I was done, I had, people calling for the show, and I'd never really been able to stop it because I had so many people calling. I wasn't able to move on to anything else. They wouldn't let me.
What really gets the audience going are the tricks. There are plungers juggled between the legs, and the audience is invited to throw tennis balls at a tube attached to Olson's forehead. One of Olson's favorite tricks is to place a kid on top of a milk crate, hands together, straight up over their head. The drum rolls, along with hundreds of mittens. The kid's looking nervous, and Olson, standing behind him, starts tossing hula hoops at him, kind of like human horseshoes. That's what attracts people like Joe Vinchek on a freezing cold day.
I find him very creative and hilarious, actually, quite funny.
Olson says he's got three goals for his show. He wants to expand it beyond Ottawa, Montreal, and Toronto, where they play now. He wants people to have fun, and he wants people to think about reusing and recycling. Some people have said he should move on to bigger issues like climate change. Recycling is old news. But in Ottawa, where Olson lives, and in many other cities, they're running out of space for their garbage. That's why he argues everyday actions do matter.
Every little thing you do adds up. It's like when we first started Junkyard Symphony, we made our money on the street, by somebody chucking in a quarter. And eventually, all those quarters added up to my tuition. So if everybody just did a little bit of thing, that'll add up to, having a cleaner environment.
Olson blows into a homemade didgeridoo and aims it at the nearest kid. It's the traditional Australian instrument, but this one is made from a long piece of PVC piping. Olson doesn't talk much during his show, and he definitely doesn't preach. He believes if you inspire positive feelings, if you get them to laugh, you're more likely to inspire people to take positive action as well. For the Environment Report, I'm Karen Kelly.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. You know, a lot of people think pollution from factory pipes and sewage outlets is a thing of the past. And you'd think after 35 years or so of seriously working on the problem, it would be a thing of the past. But a lot of municipal sewer treatment plants are in disrepair or overwhelmed during storms, and raw sewage is washed into rivers, lakes, and oceans all too often. It's a real problem, and the White House is cutting a loan program to help fix it. We can't afford a loan program to clean up the waste we flush down the toilet and keep it out of the same places we get our drinking water? Somebody's going to have to explain that one to me. Mark Brush is my co-editor. He was really getting into the beat of the junkyard music this week. Rebecca Williams is our chief reporter. We can't keep her off the new online encyclopedia that's to list all living things on Earth. She's got a while before she'll get through all of it. We've got links to that site and more information on all the stories you heard today at environmentreport.org. And if you want to drop us a line, our email address is feedback@environmentreport.org. In 2 weeks, we're making a change. Starting March 17th, the Environment Report podcast will be updated daily. A new episode on news of the environment every weekday. The Environment Report is a tiny little division of Michigan Radio at the University of Michigan.
Support for the Environment Report podcast comes from the Nature Conservancy, working to protect nature and preserve life worldwide. For Michigan and Great Lakes information, nature.org/Michigan. Support for Environment Report stories comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gunn Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. Send your comments about the Environment Report to feedback@environmentreport.org.